Peter, and this is episode 8 of Cinepunks.
Episode 8, with our guest, special guest today, Mr. Jason Shevchuk.
Of such bands as Bound, Kid Dynamite, None More Black. We will obviously only be talking about Bound today, though, so I hope everyone is prepared.
I was hoping in the back of my mind you would say that.
That would be the only thing?
Yeah.
Yes, I like that.
So how are you, Jay?
I'm good.
To see you.
I'm good.
Thanks for doing this for us. Thanks for coming down from North Jersey.
Yeah.
All the way to Philadelphia to do this with us. We really appreciate it.
It's a far travel, in a sense. It's like another world.
It's nice, because, I mean, it was a nice day. It is a nice day, not
once. Beautiful outside.
It is. Yeah. And I don't get to drive that often, so, because I take a train to work.
Right.
And it's nice to just hop on the turnpike and open it up, you know?
Very good. Yeah, you got to let it roar, man.
Yeah. 65, 70.
Yeah. So we'll talk about some of the stuff that we usually talk about, which is like things we've seen and whatever. Talk to Jay a little bit. Some of you, obviously, you're listening to this because you know who he is. Some of you just love us and they want to know who you are and why we want to talk to you. So we'll talk about that a little bit. We just want to establish, we want to say thank you. When you're a guest on this show, there's a lot that's expected of you, but not a lot of podcasts are they like, can you help us figure out how to make this work? So to give you an idea, I'm currently looking at the Google search on my phone of reliable USB hubs, since that was not a thing we had. So I also want to say thank you. As we continue to post episodes, we get more and more people talking about us. And
a few more listeners day by day.
Yeah, so thank you. Please tell your friends. And as we said, we're willing to trade love for love. So if you have something you want us to talk about, we're all excited about that. Speaking of which, there's an art show. Did that start yesterday?
The Loud Fast Philly.
I think
it started yesterday at Grind Core House.
Do you know about Loud Fast Philly, Jay? Do you know anything about this? So Joe Gervasi, who is part of Exhumed Films.
He was one of the Cabbage Collective kids back in the day.
Yeah. So he has this project where he's interviewing people involved in Philadelphia punk rock. Mm. And it's been a pretty broad range so far. I mean, you just posted...
They just interviewed Vern for it.
Right.
Vern Laird. Point of view.
And then he's done like people who are in bands I never even heard of from back in the day. Mm-hmm. And it's been all over the place. So as part of that project, he has a photographer who always does like portraits of the people he's interviewing, you know. So that show is going on right now at Grindcore House,
mm-hmm.
Which, by the way, is where we purchased our delicious
coffee for
today.
Today's episode.
Yeah, totally.
Nice.
So big ups to both Grindcore and Joe Gervasi.
Right. He also does the Exhumed Films. Did we say that?
We did. That's actually how I started.
Right.
And they're at iHouse?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're at iHouse. Are you an Exhumed Film fan? Are you into genre film?
Yeah. But back when it was in Pensauken.
Right.
Yeah, at the Harwin.
Yeah, that was the last.
Wow.
When they lost that theater.
Yeah.
I guess that theater, just they destroyed it, right? They ended up tearing it down. Because it was in the middle of nowhere.
It was not in good condition when we went there.
But we had a lot of good times there.
It was really fun, man.
Yeah. Did you ever go to any shows there? They didn't do them a lot, but they occasionally did shows there. There was a Burnside show there that devolved into a fight, I'm pretty sure.
Weird.
I feel like the AC Skins came out to that show.
Oh, boy.
I think it was bad. But that was the one show I went there.
It was interesting because I can't stay up that late anymore to watch movies.
Like, right.
I went to see The Dark Knight. The last Dark Knight movie that was a midnight showing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got home. I had to wait at Penn Station in New York till the 5 a.m. train. So
we got
out of that theater at like 3:30 in the morning.
And
I was like, terrible. Kill me. But I mean, we were all much younger back in the Pensauken and Exhumed days where I would just drink a huge thing of soda and a huge thing of popcorn and watch
two movies.
The Howling. There was one night we did four, I think. Like the sun was coming up when we left.
That's amazing.
Well, they do the 24-hour-thon now.
That's crazy. And
the 24-hour-thon is like such an established thing. You know, recently, there's a website I write for film in Austin called Synapse, and they have people who write all over, but the main thing is in Austin. And they got an invite to that Housecore Horror-thon. You know what that thing is?
No, what is it?
Phil Anselmo?
Yeah, Phil Anselmo has his own label, Housecore Records.
Sorry to cut you off, but is that in any relation to Synapse Films?
No. Okay. It's actually, and it's spelled slightly different. It's a CIN, like Cinema Synapse, whatever. I know, we get that all the time, too. And I kind of said that when they came up with the name, but naming anything, a band, a website, a podcast, for example,
right,
are all sort of difficult. So when they were, like, set, like, Synapse is the name, I wasn't going to be like, nah, dudes, it's dumb. You know, like, I was like, cool, you found a name, great. And it even came with, like, a neat logo, so whatever. Point is, they got invited to cover Housecore Horror Fest, or whatever it is, his thing. The problem
where does,
is, like,
where does Phil Anselmo
so he does this in Austin.
Right.
And it's a combination metal fest, horror fest.
So it's bands and movies?
Yeah, and last year's it was like what you would expect, like Down, Crowbar, mm-hmm. Super Joint Ritual, I think, played, that sort of stuff. And then bands on his label, some of which are cool, some of which are bands I don't like. But the combination, like, the bands were all right, and then they showed a bunch of, like, horror films. Some were cool, like Necromantic 2 on 35mm.
Really?
Some were like new movies, so it was like Blu-ray, whatever. I wasn't really stoked on that part. But it was like kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
But the point is, it was expensive. And so getting invited to cover it, I'm the only guy on the site who likes that kind of music. So even the dudes who live in Austin are like, I'm not going to that crap. So I was talking to my wife, and she was just like, well, maybe you should go to Austin to cover it. And I was starting to get stoked on the idea, like, yeah, I could go to Austin. It'd be really fun, hang out, have this badge, whatever. And then I was like, oh, it's probably going to conflict with a 24-hour horror-a-thon. Maybe I shouldn't go.
Fuck that, man. Dude, we've been to multiple 24-hour.
But I'm that Here's committed the to the 24-hour horror-a-thon.
But the 24-hour marathon is held at the iHouse, which, you know, arguably is very uncomfortable seats to sit in for 24 hours.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's a hard stop,
Any
man.
Seat is uncomfortable for 24
hours.
This is true.
But those seats in particular are...
They're like old waiting room seats. They're all like wooden.
It's
and,
terrible.
Yeah. Oh, they have since put padding on them. They're at least padded now.
Yeah.
But they don't recline.
No,
they don't recline. That's
no
true.
Give.
That's true. We're
straight up, too.
Yeah.
They're
I
not
know.
Like lean back.
Don't get me wrong. I'm convinced on the comfy seats. I'm going to see Godzilla tonight. We're going to the Marl tonight.
Have you been to the Marl
tonight? Entirely
yet?
Because the seats are full recline.
Is that the advanced seating?
Literally,
yeah. It's
you
advanced
can
assigned
fully
seating.
Recline.
And it's leather love seats that fully recline with leg rests.
You could lay
and
down
feel,
and
eat,
go
eat.
To sleep. And people could still walk past you. And not just regular, like, large people with kids could walk past you while you're reclined.
They took out, like, 100 seats per theater.
And you eat dinner?
No. They don't have the dinner. That's the Collegeville one. Which
oh,
we
the
been
movie
to
tavern?
Yet.
I've been to the movie tavern a
well,
couple times.
You think about it, like, the first 5 or 10 rows are useless anyway. Like, you can't get a good,
no,
you know,
like,
good
if,
view.
If you go in your average movie theater, like... A third of the theater is sitting somewhere that they're annoyed about. If the theater's full, at least a third of the theater's going, this seat fucking sucks.
Am I
like,
the only
I can't...
one then that doesn't mind the front seat?
Yeah,
I don't
you're
mind.
An idiot.
No way, dude. It's total immersion without
no,
being 3D.
No, awful.
Yeah,
no,
no
it hurts my face.
I, mean,
I can't even do it.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't do it? You can't do front row?
I'd choose not to. I mean...
Huh.
Don't get me wrong. I've done it like... I'm so committed to seeing this movie right now. If there's no other seats, I'm going to sit in the front. Yeah, I've done that, but I'd rather not.
I think I would leave.
You think you would leave?
Front row leave?
Yes. Well, because in that circumstance, you're probably in a position where you're sitting around in a crowded theater, which I dislike. I usually go to first showings.
Right.
You know, I'd rather sit with a bunch of old people.
Yeah.
But you're, I would be put in a position that I'm uncomfortable with anyway. So if I have to sit in the front row...
That means everyone's around you, and that sucks anyway, fuck it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I told you my look was, I'm like working now, so I can't do this as much as I used to, but my look was, if there's like a big block, you know, like Captain America came out, I'm not going Thursday night. And remember, the Thursday night opening used to be the midnight?
Yeah, now it's
Now they
8
start
o'clock.
At like 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's just like, movies just come out on Thursday.
Which I'm fine with.
Yeah, whatever, that's fine. But like for me, Friday morning, man.
Ooh.
Like go to...
Like the 9:45, 10 o'clock showing?
Breakfast food, bring it in
what?
With you. That's what we did for Captain America. It was like Wawa breakfast.
So you had like a fucking, like a egg and sausage and...
I had 2 Sizzlies.
Good lord.
I
That
rocked.
Is the maneuver.
It was good.
See, but now you're trading soda and popcorn for coffee and breakfast sandwiches.
I'm stoked on that.
Yeah?
I'm into it. Yo, so the reason I could stay in Austin for a Housecore Horror-a-thon is because I go to Austin for Fantastic Fest. Or I have for 2 years. I didn't go last year because I was poor. I'm going again this year because I was
so... You got your tickets and all that?
Basically, I was so bummed out last year that when we had a little extra money, Suze was like, why don't you buy a ticket? Because I don't want you sitting around the house being sad again. I'm like, all right. So I'm going to Fantastic Fest in Austin. And my favorite move is over the weekend, the Alamo Draft House does brunch. So
why do they do screenings?
Yeah. So like the first show of the day, it's not even that early. It's like 11:30 maybe or 12. I don't remember the exact time, but it was like later in the morning. But I specifically went like stoked, like I'm gonna have fucking eggs and chorizo while I watch this movie. Like life is perfect. You know what I mean?
It's pretty good.
And like the first movie of the day is oftentimes not even the best movie, but I'm like, I need to fucking go and do this brunch thing. Like I'm about that. I love that.
That's awesome. Yeah. I would do that. That sounds fun.
I mean, they do. The thing about Fantastic Fest is, like, you could burn so much money, though, on that Alamo food. Like, you're just in the theater all day.
Mm.
And, like, to go get food, a lot of times you're, like, missing a movie. Like, I'm not going to see a movie now, so I can go buy food. So you just end up buying food in the theater. And it is, like, full dinner. But it's a limited menu, and it's kind of expensive. So, like, if you do that more than a couple days, not only have you used up all your money, you're kind of like, oh, my stomach. I've eaten all this, like...
shitty food.
It's not... I mean, let's be fair. Partly because I don't want to trash off the Alamo, but just like in general, the food's all right. I mean, it's all right food. It's fine. Yeah, but it's just, it's certainly better than like popcorn. They do popcorn, but it's better than that, you know.
Fair enough. Do you do festivals like this at all? No?
No.
Okay, here's my question for you, Jason. What is your movie taste?
I mean, I'm very...
Like what kind of movies are you?
Why don't we start? Why don't we start with the intro question? Remember this? We were supposed to do this.
No, I don't.
Hey, how'd you get into movies?
Oh, jeez.
We usually start with how you got into music, but let's start with the movies thing first, since we already went there.
Sure. Yeah.
How'd you get into movies? What was it?
It's not hard to get into movies.
Right, but I mean, like, I know a lot of people who say they love movies, and their interest in movies is kind of like my interest in TV, like. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
But they don't care about it past that point. Like,
you're a passionate dude about movies.
As someone who cares about it, how'd that happen? How did you end up in that space?
I'm trying to think. I was born in Trenton.
Okay.
All right. So
sorry, we've had some technical difficulties.
I was in the second grade when my family moved from Trenton to rural Ringo's, New Jersey, which is in the middle of the woods, and this was in the 80s. So I guess my first introduction to movies was probably home video.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have cable because our house was so far from the road. Back then, there wasn't free installation.
No.
Like there is now. You had to pay per foot. Like they had to actually put the cables out there. There was no cable.
It wasn't there waiting for you.
It wasn't there.
You.
It took years for us to get cable. So my dad brought home a Betamax player. We actually had an antenna, like a huge antenna.
Oh, yeah, no.
That we would have to dial in to get television.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, even living in the city, I used to try to hang off the antenna. Yeah. I thought that was part of the fun.
Our antenna was like a tower that had to go up because of all the trees.
Yeah.
Good.
It was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
But frightening.
Yeah.
Anyway, my dad bought a Betamax player, and from then we started to rent and purchase movies, and I specifically remember Michael Jackson's Thriller, which was the short film version of the video, and then afterwards was a feature-length documentary on the making of Thriller.
Yeah.
Which... was kind of life-changing for me, I guess, because one of the things I love most about Blu-rays and DVDs are the special features, and especially when they include the making-of process. I love the process of making movies. In a lot of cases, I watch that more often than the feature.
Really?
Yeah.
Any movies in particular that you really like the special stuff to, or the... that you can think on and you're like, oh man, that shit is so cool.
Yeah, I think any Rob Zombie title usually has a really extensive behind the scenes making of. Like they're there through the whole process, which is pretty cool. And it's better than, you know, if you don't like Halloween 2, I still recommend getting that title just for the making extra of. Yeah.
Wow. I hear that Halloween 2, though, of the two Halloweens he did, that Halloween 2 is actually the good one, and that the first one is kind of painful.
No.
That's what people told me. I haven't seen either.
You haven't seen either of them?
My Rob Zombie experience is I saw, you know, House of Thousand Corpses in the theater and was like, I don't think I like that. And then didn't go see Devil's Rejects, and then rented it later and was like, oh, actually, this one's pretty good. And then so many people talk trash on the Halloween that I just didn't... I gave up on Rob Zombie for...
Well, are you a Rob Zombie fan?
I appreciate him.
Yeah, I mean, the process, but the movies. Yeah. You like the movies.
I think I do, more so than I don't like them. I mean... The standard criticism is his writing is terrible, and and it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, you don't get this from watching these behind the scenes, but like I don't know who's to blame for that. If it really is poor writing, or if some of that stuff is written at all, because there just seems to be a lot of gratuitous language for the sake of not having anything else to say.
Mm. You know? Well, I do have a friend who got a Rob Zombie script and was like really bummed out because it was filled with like basic grammatical and spelling errors and that sort of thing.
Really?
But this is someone who actually likes his movies and wanted to be in a movie. So it's not like he went into it like really negative. He just was reading the script like, fuck, this is like really bad. But still was thinking about doing the movie. So I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't get people who are... I don't get the, like, obsession with him. Like, people who really like, Rob Zombie movies are so great. I assume it's, like, people like his music, and that's part of it. But I also don't get the hatred either, like, of the... Like I said, I didn't see the Halloween movies, but I did see...
Lords of Salem?
Lords of Salem, and I thought that was great.
I hated that movie.
That's so funny!
Holy shit, I hated that movie.
I loved
it. That movie, here's what I hated about it, and this is what I think I hate about Rob Zombie in particular. His influence are so they're so there that it doesn't feel like it's a real movie to me.
You feel like it's like an homage?
I feel like I'd rather watch a Tarantino movie, because that's what it is to me. Because it's so rife. I mean, if Tarantino drew from the pool of, as opposed to blaxploitation, as opposed to exploitation film, if he drew from horror films, that's what it would be.
Huh.
In my mind.
Huh.
I mean, feel free to disagree with me. I'm just
saying. I don't know what I think about that. Yeah, I'll have to think about that some more.
I mean, I don't know. There isn't... I mean, come on. Lords of Salem? You really like that movie?
I really liked it. Did you see Lords of Salem?
Oh, no. Goodness. I mean, wow.
I'd like to see it. I don't know why I didn't. I missed it. It just was gone.
I literally watched it...
it was in the theater for like a week.
Yeah. Well, I didn't go to see it in theater. I was in Austin. Suze was interviewing for a job, and I was in Austin, and I got really sick. And so we were like, let's stay home while I just recover, because I just got... ill, and she fell asleep, and I found it on TV, and I'm like, you know, I've never seen this. I'll just leave it on. It was literally just on a pay channel, and I was like, not invested in any way, shape, or form. I watched the whole thing, and I was like, that was great. Like, I was so stoked on it. We totally derailed the question, by the way. We've only got to you like Thriller.
Oh right.
Yeah. So we should probably keep going from there.
So yeah, I mean, from there it was we upgraded to VHS. I eventually got my own. VHS player with some birthday money one summer. And, like, my summers were spent, like, during elementary school and high school. I mean, when I wasn't able to go to a friend's house or...
Right.
Like, I mean, I don't know if we recorded this, but...
we did. Like, no, it was we got to the word Trenton and the whole system crashed, just so you guys know.
I lived so remotely, like, so far from any of my friends that it was impossible to just... hop on a bike and go there until I got my license. But you had to like sleep over someone's house or have them sleep over, which usually ended up you stayed up all night watching movies anyway.
Right.
But yeah, I think my obsession with collecting movies definitely started like in the sixth or seventh grade.
Yeah.
My brother was working at a video store. He would constantly bring home like used movies that they were selling. And my uncle had cable at the time, and I would go through the TV guide and circle what I wanted him to record, and he would just bring back, you know, whatever I wanted.
Mm.
And this was, I mean, you could fit three movies on a VHS tape in long play.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, one DVD or something or a Blu-ray, you're limited to, whatever data rate. It's like you had one. you would just tape over movies. So you it's funny, like you would watch one movie and then, you know, there'd be the gap before the next movie and you'd see what you taped over like immediately after. So that was kind of interesting.
I mean, I remember long play. Like, I remember thinking, when I realized what that was, I remember thinking, like, why did I not record everything this way? I could get so much stuff on the tape.
I would stay up all night in the summers and just watch the same movies over and over again.
Wow. Like, do you remember which movies were, like, go-tos?
I would watch Goonies over and over
again. Yes!
So good.
I would watch The Breakfast Club over and over again.
Right.
Can't Buy Me Love. Over and over
again. Shit.
Is that the one with, which one was that one with the pizza guy?
Patrick Dempsey. That's Loverboy.
Loverboy, sorry.
But yeah, movies like Bill and Ted, like all shit like that. I would stay up all night, like cataloging my baseball cards and putting them into the computer or whatever, like putting stickers on them and so I knew where they were. And I would just have movies on repeat. And even if I wasn't watching, I would just, listening to them was soothing to me.
Yeah,
and then from there, it became an obsession with me.
Do you remember, are you into directors, and was there a first director that you started to care about?
John Hughes.
Wow. So it wasn't just those movies, it was like knowing
Hughes. Yeah, like it was him and, you know, Spielberg's the obvious first choice when you're a kid, you know, because...
E.T. and...
Yeah.
Yeah, Jaws and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't... That's funny. Like, I don't remember actually a specific moment where I started to realize what a director was and that I liked a group of movies, you know? Hmm. I think it might have been easier for John Hughes because he used the same cast a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Anthony Michael Hall was sort of woven through a lot of that Brat Pack era. Like, Weird Science and 16 Great Candles.
Mm-hmm.
Is The Breakfast Club your favorite one? That's the one.
Yeah, for sure.
Man.
I have a real appreciation for the one with, you know what, I'm just going to ruin this, so I'm not even going to try it. It's because it's a John Hughes movie, but it doesn't really have any of the standard Brat Pack folks in it. And it specifically has Casey Jones from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie in it. And April O'Neil from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie in it. Yeah, but they don't have, like, main roles. And Casey Jones is playing this, like, tough skinhead. But the main people are, what's that girl's name? Mary Louise Parker, maybe? And Eric Stoltz.
Oh, Some Kind of Wonderful.
Some Kind of Wonderful.
Yeah, okay.
That one, for whatever reason...
That's the drummer one? That's the one where with the...
Yeah.
The short lady is the drummer?
Yeah. And, like, I don't know if I got into it as a kid... because I recognized two characters from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles who I didn't... It never occurred to me... Like, watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, no one in that movie felt like I would see them in other movies ever.
Right.
Like, I figured, like, that was it. You know what I mean? Like, as a kid. And then to see them in another movie that was so different, I was like, hey, they're in that other movie. And I just started watching that one a lot, And I think it was also the punk rock angle, like, the fact that he was, like, this tough punk, you know, in it.
And that movie gets quoted in the Bouncing Souls song, that these are the quotes from our favorite 80s movies. All I care about is me and my drums and you.
I did not know
that movie.
I did not
My favorite John Hughes movie is a Dark Horse pick. My favorite is 3 o'clock High. Not Beethoven.
Did he write 3 o'clock High?
I believe he did. He wrote and directed that, didn't he? With Casey Shamosko.
I'm going to go out on a limb. I don't think he had anything to do with 3 o'clock High.
I'm quite sure that's
Can we do some research?
Man.
Well, yeah. So this is something we also need to work. We're learning as we podcast.
Typically,
and,
there are two computers open.
We usually have a computer open with IMDb.
Do you want me to just run over and grab my phone?
We've been so stressed. No, I don't want to use my... I feel like the phone is what messes the sound, but I don't know my
laptop. I have a copy of 3 o'clock High somewhere. We could just look at the DVD box.
I really don't think
Keep an eye on the sound, so make sure that the cell phone doesn't mess up the sound.
This is going to totally suck if I'm wrong.
I hope you're right.
Fucking movie, though.
You can still love it.
I know, but
you can love it without it being a John Hughes movie.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. It's like,
it certainly is a dark horse.
It's the dark horse pick because I figured it was the one that not too many people loved. But it's one of those movies that when, you know how, like, when you first get cable or what?
Yeah.
And have HBO, like, there's certain movies that are in constant rotation that you will always see.
Yeah.
That was one of those movies for me, like, when we first got cable.
So it was written by Richard Matheson.
Yeah, son of a gun.
And it was directed by Phil.
So it had nothing to do. So that is the darkest horse pick that you can
because
ever
see. Because it's nowhere related to John Hughes.
I was convinced. You know why? Now I'm feeling all fucked up because I thought that was part of like a Brat Pack grouping.
I think he only directed a handful of movies.
Yeah.
He was
really
he wrote a lot.
Which is why, but Some Kind of Wonderful is definitely him.
Yeah, I don't think he directed it.
Oh, he wrote it?
I'm not even positive he wrote it.
Fuck, he might have produced it. I really thought that was a John Hughes. Maybe we just don't know anything about John Hughes. Yeah, and we just see 80s movies and we're like, this is a John Hughes movie.
Very clearly. Sherman Oaks.
You know what? Let's just get a list. This is the worst film podcast that's ever existed.
Yeah, we're totally fucked.
There was an episode where we went for almost five minutes over Starship Troopers.
And Eva was yelling at his computer.
Starship Troopers. Tragic, really. It's like the most obvious thing.
He didn't direct Some Kind of Wonderful.
Fuck.
Oh, man.
But I'm not even positive he wrote it.
Hey, any legitimate film fans out there that have actually listened to this podcast, we just want to apologize to you right now.
Yeah.
We're total posers.
He wrote it.
Huh.
Woo! Yes!
All right. But I mean, it's still... His voice is in that movie.
That's true, that's true. From a long time, I felt like that was a John Hughes movie.
Yeah, one of my favorites is Career Opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, John Hughes, okay, so this is like, you're pretty young. As you're growing up, did your film taste change? Were there other directors that appealed to you? Was there any sort of shifts in what you cared about when it came to film?
No. I'll absorb it all. Take it all in.
Okay.
I think, like... Excuse me. I knew that I wanted to be involved in making movies when I was a kid, you know?
Wow.
I knew it probably from watching Thriller.
Yeah.
That Betamax probably had more of an influence on my life musically and, film wise than anything. I think when I went to film school is when I started to really be opened up to new.
So where'd you go to film school?
UArts.
Oh, okay.
Right down the street.
How was that?
It was all right.
Totally didn't know that about you.
Yeah, it was all right. We were the last class to actually work in film, touch film and edit film. After that, it's all digital.
It's all digital, right?
Yeah.
What year did you graduate?
99.
Okay.
Are you a purist when it comes to film? Do you like watching movies on film?
I don't care either way. I mean, I'm not opposed to digital, and if a good film print's a good film print, and a good projection's a good projection, you know.
Yeah.
As long as something is shot nice, I don't really see a difference.
See, Liam cares about that stuff, and I don't.
Yeah.
I don't give a shit about it.
I do. Well, let's clarify that.
I mean, it's not going to change. It's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
So you might this is something,
because my stepdad brought this up to me, too, that he was whatever. And I do like, I'm not against digital.
Mm.
I think my worry is that we're going to lose a bunch of films. I mean, there's been a big effort with Blu-ray to convert. I don't know if you noticed, but it seems like actually, if you compare what was made available on DVD to what's being made available on Blu-ray, there's been this like weird effort to like delve into weird areas, place films that never came out, some of which never even came out on any home video, have been released on Blu-ray. So there's some hope there that certain films won't disappear. Mm. But my worry is with the complete rejection of film as a medium whatsoever is that we're going to lose some movies. Inevitably, some movies are just going to go away, and maybe they shouldn't have gone away. And B, I really like the way that film looks. I like it. And all that, though, to say, I want to definitely like roll back a little bit and say I'm not against digital because it's so much easier to make movies with digital. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, it was hard to, when everything was on film, becoming a filmmaker was like...
Yeah,
I don't want to say an impossible task, but it was definitely hard at the very least, especially as money became more of an issue. Like, it almost seems like the fact that people made independent films into the 90s and whatever was kind of amazing because it's like, how do you pay for all that film stock? How do you pay for that? Whereas now, like, anyone. But there's also this weird part of me that's like, is it okay that anyone is doing it?
You're right about that. There's an interesting documentary called Side by Side.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
No.
Which it's hosted by Keanu Reeves. He kind of goes through. I know you laugh, but it's actually really interesting, and it kind of.
I saw this. It's on Netflix.
It talks to anyone you would want to hear an opinion from about film versus digital, and it really does a really great job explaining the differences. But one of the interesting things is to go back to your comment about how hard it is to be a filmmaker and in the film world, like because you have to. Buy film. You have to process it. You have to transfer it.
Yeah.
There was a short time in the late 90s, early 2000s where digital video like people were making movies with digital video. Like Spike Lee made a great movie called Bamboozled.
Yeah, so good. On a
single chip, you know, a bunch of single chip cameras. Mm. And that was an era where it was really accessible for anyone to make a movie because you could do it on like this laptop.
Yeah.
But now we're starting to move into another era of this 4K resolution.
Yeah.
Where it's almost like you're shooting film because I'm going through this now. This experience is where, you know, you have this camera that captures this raw data, which is the file sizes are huge. You could fit maybe a half an hour on an SSD drive, which cost $400 or $500 a piece.
Jesus Christ.
If you're shooting raw 4K, you know, you're getting a half an hour on each. Then you need a drive, a RAID system to store that all that footage and play it. You need a drive fast enough to do all that stuff. So you're kind of getting back to this process of, instead of processing film, you are transcoding digital files before you can even edit them, you know, and then color grade them based off of, instead of a negative, you're going back to a raw file. So
yeah.
the process, it hit a lull with digital video because you could just capture it, edit one-to-one, and you're done, you know, then you just export it and you're finished. Now it's getting back to this process where it does get pretty expensive.
So, A, I'm right, George. Screw you. No, I'm just kidding. But B, that like kind of bums me out because that, first of all, I do aesthetically feel like, and don't get me wrong, a lot of film prints are just bad film prints. Like, I'll see movies I love all the time, and you're like, oh, this is kind of pink. This is kind of rough. The sound here is bad. So I get to just the extent of, like, projection-wise, you know, it's just easier to project digital in some ways. But the things that bother me is, A, the thing that I really like about digital is that it would be more accessible. So the idea that it's less accessible or that it's becoming less accessible bums me out. B, the part that when you have this conversation people don't always talk about is the theater aspect. And this is what I don't like. So obviously transporting digital is cheaper for companies than transporting films. So like a film company, a distribution company, to send you all those film canisters.
You don't need to strike a print.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you're saving so much money. Mm-hmm. But for theaters that have been brought up with film to convert, especially to 4K, that's a lot of money. And that's the part no one's talking about. And for me, that really bums me out because if you break out the film world into all the different aspects, you know, you have the people who are writing and making movies, the people who are part of the production team, the people who are, you know, buying and selling these movies and distributing them, and the people who are showing the movies. Actually, the part that's always appealed to me is the showing, the theatrical aspect, the presentation. That's the thing I've cared about more than anything else. Now, don't get me wrong, I'd love to be in movies, writing movies, but I gave up on that shit. I'm like a dream giver-upper more than a dream pursuer. So, like, I wanted to be an actor until I switched schools, and I was like, oh, you have to start over at this new school? Fuck it. I'm doing something else, you know? So like, for me, the thing that I've really cared about, because it seems that it's becoming like no one gives a fuck, is presentation. Now, if you live in New York, you know, you're in North Jersey right now, so I'm sure you go to movies in New York.
I work in New York.
So yeah, you work in New York.
Majority of the movies I see.
Yeah, so it's still pretty cool, but let me clue you into what it's like here in Philadelphia if you don't know. Or I've talked to people in other parts of the country. Theaters are closing, and the theaters that are left suck, and they don't care what the movie looks like.
Is the Ritz digital now?
The Ritz is almost 100% digital.
Because they were sold to Landmark? Okay.
They kept a film projector just to have it so for they can occasionally do stuff. But they almost never do repertory. Almost never. It's like special events.
And what about that place on Sansom?
The Roxy?
Yeah.
Film Society bought it. They redid it. They weren't going to do film, and they figured out how to do it. And in fact, I went to a screening of Suspiria
They still have their
beautiful
projectors?
Yeah, they got new projectors, actually. Okay. They took out all the old shit, and now they have these newer projectors. I mean, they're newer in that they weren't there before. I don't know that they're, like, new, like, nice, but they're in there. And they were worried for a long time. When we were in the Film Society, they were saying they might not do film. So the fact that they're doing it is cool. The bummer about the Roxy is it's so small.
Talk about uncomfortable seats. Yeah. I think that place takes the cake.
They redid all the seats.
Because if you're gonna toy with getting rid of film, which is the only reason anyone would ever go there,
yeah,
is to see a movie in a 35 millimeter print that they will never get to see anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because those seats are awful. Like, you're not luring me in there to see a digital projection.
No. Well, and mostly what they do with digital, they're just now starting to do some 35 millimeter stuff. And they hired someone to do these, like, repertory screenings. So they did the Suspiria, and the person who was there was like, no, they didn't believe me that this would sell out. I'm like, this is a 50-seat theater. You're showing a 35-millimeter of Suspiria.
Yeah.
It's going to sell out, but like they didn't know that that was like a moneymaker. So now it's, I don't know. So they're doing it like once a month. But the whole point of that being the screen is so small. Though, like, I've definitely been in people's home theaters in their house that have a bigger screen than the screen.
Than the one at the Roxy.
And that like kind of bums me out a little bit. Granted, at this point in Philly, I'm not going to be that. Like, we'll just be honest. We have beef with the Film Society.
We do. You know
we
that?
Don't.
No.
Yeah, we don't.
Oh, wait. I think I've heard.
Yeah, we did.
My latest beef with the Roxy in particular is that Melania and I had donated money to it, and they put a brick with our name on it, and they changed my last name to Joshua Georges instead of Joshua Alvarez and Melania Georges. So it's Joshua and Melania Georges.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See that? That's what that gets you. That's just saying, mistake. Man.
It's $500, right?
Yeah. Like,
$500, your name should be right. That's about that. If you donated like $100, I'd be like, yeah, you're
right. Did you complain?
Well,
did you file a complaint?
Oh my God, the complaining we've done. It's almost unbelievable that Melani was so upset about the way she was.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It is what it is.
Yeah, we've moved on.
The point being is that.
Or you could just change your last name.
That's
yeah,
true.
That's also
you should
possibly.
Probably just
or
change
Or I should
it.
Do some guerrilla style tactics. Go in there with a fucking marker.
Yeah, that's also
cross
true.
That shit
is
right
it,
out
is it,
the
is it engraved or is it just written?
I haven't seen it because I refused to go in there. They told us that that's what it said. And then Liam just breaks the pact and goes right in there a couple times. Now,
first of all, we've never, we don't have a pact. There was no pact.
There is a pact inherent in us group hating the Film Society.
I see, but this is the difference. And it was in that interview too. So we did an interview where we talked shit on the Film Society. But to be fair, you guys were like, Film Society sucks. And I was like, yeah. The Film Society has made some mistakes, but there's still potential there. I still think that if they were to say, stop worshiping the old people who give them money and start doing things like, I don't know, a midnight screening of Suspiria on 35mm, like do that on a regular basis, then they could redeem themselves pretty easily. And that's what the whole point, the only reason I brought up that we have beef with them is to say that despite our beef with them, I want to support the Roxy. I want it to be a thing because there's so little shit in Philly. Literally, film, you've got the Roxy, and you've got the International House. There's no other regular thing for 35mm in the whole city of Philadelphia. It's 1.5 million people. It doesn't make any sense.
So you donated $500 to the Film Society.
We donated, on top of our $1,000 a year for the two of us to be members of the Film Society for the year, we donated $500 to the Roxy Project because at the time they were building it and they wanted to have it open for the film festival.
Where does that money go?
It was to like renovate the
Roxy.
So the Roxy was closed,
yeah.
Done, and they like I don't know if they bought it or rented it or what their relationship
bought
is.
It flat out,
I don't know. All I know is that money was to renovate it, which it's renovated. I mean, it's definitely nicer than it was.
So here's what happened: we went to the Hit Record Joe show at the Merriam Theater with Joseph Gordon-Levitt was doing this live thing, and it was sponsored by the Film Society. So we went. And there are people there that were thanking everybody for their donations, and they had this whole thing like, even $1, we're going to thank you. And they didn't thank us for the $500 donation. So when we brought it up to the lady, she was like, oh, let me look into it. And then the next thing you knew, like, they're saying that they'd never gotten it, but it was taken from our account and all
yeah,
this.
They lost your $500.
Yeah, and then they said they didn't have it and all this other stuff. And we're like, well, don't really know what that's about. And then Greenwood.
You know what? We've dealt with this enough. Let's go on to more interesting things. So you studied film at University of the Arts, where you were not a member of the Film Society, is what I'm getting. did you have a specialty? Like, I understand their program is very much about like hands-on production, like working and making stuff.
It might be now, and I'm glad it is now because
what were you doing at the time?
It was very specific each year. It's like. First year, you don't do anything. Freshman year, it's foundation year.
Right.
So you're exploring every other art except what you went to school for, which I think is bullshit.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I'd rather spend 4 years focusing on
what you want to do
than focusing on a bunch of bullshit that
yeah.
I'm never going to bind a book in my life. You
never.
Know? But you're going to make me take this fucking class, you know?
The book binding class.
Yeah. retarded. Now I'm all angry. So yeah, sophomore year, you take animation.
Okay.
And you take the fundamentals, like you get bowl X's and you rent them out or whatever. We had an equipment room, and you learn how to expose film. Mm-hmm. Reversal. You shoot 16mm reversal. And then junior year is when you start to learn film sound. And that, to me, was probably the greatest class, because that was the one where they split the class into two. I think there was, I don't know, maybe 12, 15 kids in the class. Mm-hmm. And you, from sophomore to senior year, you're all together. And you're focused on film. So, I lost my train of thought. Okay, yeah. So, they split the class up, and everybody gets a task. Like, you're going to make a movie. So, somebody writes it, somebody directs it, somebody lights it, somebody, you know, does camera.
Yeah.
People act in it.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was the model of how I thought the rest of my time there should have gone.
Right. Yeah.
Then, senior year, you're on your own to make a thesis film.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
But I feel like they spent a lot of time watching.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time watching movies and humoring our professor's syllabus. You know, like, we had a professor who was really interested in time. So he would just, you know, force these themes on us, you know, about playing with time, where we weren't learning anything. We were just kind of like doing what he wanted us to do. Like, we weren't learning, we weren't getting better at the craft. We were just, focusing on this one area of storytelling, which none of us, I don't think, took anything out of, you know. Hmm. It's nothing that we can learn on our own.
Yeah.
You know? So senior year, we had to do our own movie. And that's when I made a documentary about Stalag 13. Ghetto Venue.
Is that exist somewhere? I feel like I've seen it.
It's online.
Yeah, I've seen it.
So
it's really good.
Thanks. And then after that, I had to learn digital on my own.
Wow.
Because let's face it, you're in Philadelphia. Unless you, in, you know, early 2000s, you're not going to become a filmmaker in Philadelphia, you know.
Mm.
Let me word that differently. You're not going. You have to. That's when digital started to really change everything. You know?
Right.
So if I wanted to get a job, I had to learn how to do that shit. And that's what I did, and that's when I got my first job at a production company in South Jersey.
Wow. Have you worked on mostly commercial stuff? Have you been part of, like, what people would consider, like, movies?
It's all commercial.
Okay.
Everything I do is commercial. If I do anything movie-related, it's my own stuff.
Yeah.
Or it's band-related.
Right.
Or it's for somebody else, like a friend who needs something done on a pure independent level.
I wanna switch gears to the music aspect, knowing, of course, some people, that's where they're gonna know you from more anyway. But I was just, some of what you were saying, it seems to me kind of interesting. Like, when you look at film programs, there are film programs that are all about the hands-on production. You're gonna learn how to do this, do that. And then there are film programs that are more like literary criticism sort of programs. They're more like theory and ideas, whatever. Now, for me, since I sort of gave up on making movies, those, like, theory programs sort of appeal to me, like, academically. Like, oh, that sounds interesting. But I could see, like, someone going into that program being like, oh, this is useless, because all I want to do is make movies, and all I'm doing is watching and writing about them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the thought I had was, do you think there should be, like, clear delineations in what the study of film is about? You know what I mean? Like, I guess if you go to UArts is about making art more than it is talking about art.
Yeah, they were definitely pushing individual expression.
Right.
You know, they weren't pushing
criticism.
Get a job. You can go get a job.
Okay. That's the other aspect too, I guess, in there is you have, I want to talk about and think about movies. I want to make movies, and I want to get a fucking job and pay my bills.
I would probably say that three of us from that class are still working remotely within what we want to do.
Oh, you know, my, like, gosh.
Within the idea of, and I work with one of them.
Whoa. You know,
like, we've kind of worked together since then.
We've
kind of always, like, he's helped me out, I've helped him out. Like, whenever someone needs a job, you know, it's always there. But I would say probably maybe four are still doing it.
Wow. Huh. Well, so kids, go to York's.
Well, hey, you know what? Hopefully they change their curriculum because...
I mean, to be honest, I don't even... where I used to work, I told you before, but people don't know, I used to work at this church that was also like a social service agency. And so we got interns who were UART students. You know, every college...
Because it's right near the campus there.
Well, and every college, you know, work study, you get work study money.
Yeah.
And part of the requirement for work study money is that some of the options be like, you're helping people. And UART just didn't have many options for that sort of thing. So they just came to us and were like, do you guys want some work study people? And we're like, oh yeah, that's great. I mean, we have work to do, so whatever. So I suddenly found myself interacting with a lot of UART students, all of which were awesome, great kids, really excited, whatever. But it did seem like a lot of them would either be really excited about their programs or really unhappy. It was very strange how, you know, it would probably be about half. Half UART students thought it was the best school ever, and half were like, I hate my experience.
I feel like maybe if, like, I had a lot of friends who went for, you know, painting and sculpture.
Right.
And I highly doubt they went into class and looked at paintings for 6 hours.
Right.
Yeah. You know, they practiced their craft.
Yeah.
Whereas I think film should be the same way. I think you should. And now that it's digital, there's no excuse.
So easy.
You don't have to wait 3 days till you get your footage back. You know,
I mean, that's partly why I'm more involved in doing stuff now than when I like cared about being involved in it, because I have friends who are like comedians or actors, whoever, who are like, I haven't been cast anything in a while, so I'm just going to go get a fucking camera and film something. So like my friend Chris, I've been in two things that he's worked on just because he's like, you're loud. You'd be good. Why don't you come do it? And then I do it. He's like, oh, you're funny too. Great. You know, but it was like, just, he needed somebody and I was free. So I did it. And then like, and he was like, that's weird. You're actually okay at this. And I'm like, yeah, no, I studied acting for a while. I just gave up on it because it seemed like it wasn't going to work out. So then I just went to other stuff. Oops. But it's so much more approachable now.
It's not too late.
Right, well, totally. And I'll do, if you're listening to this and you do anything in the Philadelphia area, I will be an idiot on camera for you. Whatever the fuck it is, I will do that. But I'm not looking to build a career in that sense. I'm looking to, like, to go back to something I enjoy. But it's so much more, anyone can do it. Like, I say anyone, but we were just talking about how it's getting more difficult if you're doing a more professional. If you're going at the movie level and you're doing 4K and all this sort of stuff, it seems like it's harder. If you just want to be on YouTube... At this point, anyone can do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody can make a movie with anything.
Right.
And it can be good, you know?
I mean, yeah, I've seen some very low-fi video, or but digital movies that are still really good movies.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, even that, like that Dogma 95, like, era.
Yeah.
I mean, those things were shot bare bones with no real equipment. I mean, that was one of the rules. No tripod, even.
Yeah.
No lighting. And if you're telling a good story and it's well told, then I mean, what more do you need?
So let's go just so that people aren't like, I can't believe they talked to Jay and they never brought up any music stuff. I mean, our plan is with everyone to ask, because the idea is like we're towing the line here. Like we're also going to have, I hope, film-related people that people would be like, oh, that person's into punk? Like, crazy. Like, I didn't know they were into that. You know what I mean? In this case, it's like, oh, Jay likes movies? I didn't know that, you know? Or some people probably do, but... So let's talk about, how did you get into this thing, you know, that we kind of know you from? How did you end up... This thing we do is secret. Reveal the secret for us. How did you get involved in that? Especially because the last we heard, you're living in the fucking woods in South Jersey, watching videos by yourself,
organizing... logging my baseball cards. Can I pee first?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. Can you pause it?
Yeah.
Do we know how to do that?
The space bar.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So how did you get into this music thing? What's that about?
I guess I have to go to freshman year in high school.
Okay.
Where I met a dude named Danny Marianino, and we were in study hall, and I was a huge Metallica fan then.
You still are.
Yeah. Let me backtrack. My brother was big into music. Like, he played guitar and he had a band, and I guess just from hearing what he had when he would drive me around or whatever he had blasting out of his bedroom appealed to me. Mm-hmm. Shit like Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Metallica. Later it was Sick of It All. Biohazard. Shit like that. It was kind of on my radar.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, music was never really important to me. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it was baseball cards and movies. And wrestling. I was a huge wrestling fan.
Awesome.
So freshman year, we had study hall, and study hall was in this auditorium. So it was stadium seating.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my Game Boy out. Instead of studying, I would play my Game Boy and hide it behind the chair. It was easy to hide things. And I met Danny, who was sitting in front of me. And Danny had long hair, Metallica shirt. And he also had a Game Boy. And he saw that I was playing, and he said, "Oh, do you have Tetris? Do you have the Game Link?" So we passed the link, and we just started playing Tetris, you know, study hall. And we were in a lot of classes together, and he was in a band. He played guitar. And it was, I think junior year in high school, we were in a broadcasting class, which was radio.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a band called Nation of Hate, and they needed a bass player, and he knew that I liked metal, and he said, "You want to play bass?" I never played bass before. I never played an instrument, but it's only got four strings, so.
How hard could it be?
Yeah. It's very hard. and I was like 4 foot nothing, so me playing this, I had this. He gave me a bass. It was like this pink iridescent bass. It would change color depending on reflections. So I'd put Batman stickers on it, and that was it. I mean, I have a line in one of the Numb More Black songs that we have. It's Tripped on a Bass Line. That's kind of like how I got started playing music. So that was it through high school. We just played a couple shows. I mean, but we practiced a lot, never played shows. I mean, because there was really no outlet for us. We didn't really understand DIY or anything like that.
Yeah.
We would play Teen Arts, and we would play, which was like a showcase for, like, they would have bands, and they would have arts and crafts and, you know, shit at the Flemington Speedway. And then they had, like, the school talent show, and there was a club called Obsessions that we used to play at twice a year. But we would practice a lot and write a lot of songs, and I never wrote anything. Maybe lyrically I would contribute, but I was just there. I was just kind of, like, doing my thing, playing bass. And we recorded a lot. We recorded, like, three demos, and they each had, like, 12 songs on them. Sometimes we would re-record the same songs. It was just a different time. And from there, after high school, I took a year off before college, and there was a group of bands that we would play together, like my Nation of Hate. At the time, there was Nation of Hate and Dark Legion. Those were like the two bands.
Dark Legion.
Those were during my time in high school. Those were the two bands in the high school. Before us came like bands like Knuckle Sandwich and Inchworm. Zero SRI. These were all like the local bands. And there was another local band called Global Disaster. And we would play shows with them from time to time. And they were from a different school, but we kind of like ended up working together at Ditchman. I used to detail cars after work. In Flemington. And that's where I met Nick Remendelli, who was in Global Disaster. And after high school, the band split up. Everyone went their separate ways. I think I was watching Headbangers Ball, and Sick of It All video came on, and I was like, I want to start a new band. So I called Nick because I knew he was into the same. Like, I was just getting into straight edge and, you know, veganism. And I knew Nick was kind of going down that same path. So that's how Bound started.
Yes, Bound!
X Bound X. That's how Bound began.
Yeah.
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 So that was like college is when you were like leaving.
It was the year between high school and college. It was 95.
Wow. Wow.
94, 95.
Wow. So talk about a little bit about Bound, because I think some people know about that band, some people have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah. We were a Jersey band. And at that time, it was Jersey was awesome for shows. It was like really awesome.
Wow. Wow.
You had Manville Elks, you had The Underground, you had Handy Street, you had VFW halls in just about any town doing shows. And maybe it's not on my radar now, but like it just doesn't seem the same way anymore.
There's still some spots. There's a spot in Tom's River that does huge shows. Like big, crazy shows. And I'm always surprised when I hear about the bands that come through.
Okay. Because I feel like, I mean, back then, you were getting bands that... The caliber of bands playing VFWs were equal to bands that are playing, like, real venues now, mm-hmm. you know? And I, like, even, like, here, the University of Arts used to do shows, and those shows were awesome, you know?
Were you commuting from Jersey to UArts, or were you living in the city?
I moved to Philadelphia.
But you were still... But your band was still Jersey.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we, I mean... I feel like we were a band much longer than we actually were, because we just did a lot. We practiced a lot. Mm-hmm. We played a lot of shows.
What was the best show you feel like you guys played?
With Bound?
Yeah.
I guess it was Earth Crisis, Middlesex.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the biggest show.
Who else was on that?
I don't remember. I think it was like, it might have been You and I.
Yeah.
I'm seeing Fahrenheit 451.
That's very, very possible. Yeah,
on the flyer.
Yeah.
But it could have been. I could be merging two different Middlesex shows. It was the only show that we played at Middlesex, and that was like at the time Middlesex was the stage.
That was the mecca. Yeah, that was the one.
Man, City Gardens, I think, at that point was done.
And were there many shows in the city? Like, did you guys play in Philly at all, or was it mostly just over in Jersey?
We played one show with Lifetime at the Church.
Okay.
I think that was our only Philly show.
Yeah.
We went on tour. We did two summer tours, which were like a month long, and we played 9 shows.
Wow.
Because shows just got canceled.
Yeah.
We would end up staying at someone's house for 3 days. And just,
holy Moses.
And those shows were like, I think we went as far up as Chicago and as far down as like Tampa or something.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It was just East Coast.
Yeah.
Never made it to the Midwest or West Coast.
Right.
Yeah, put out a 7-inch and the full length, and that was kind of it. And
I only had the demo. And I had the full length.
Nick left. I think Nick left before the full length to join Autumn.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Autumn.
He was in Autumn. He was in I Hate You, too, right?
No, he wasn't in I Hate You.
There's another band that he was in that.
Like, after Autumn?
Yeah. Wasn't there?
I have no idea.
It's possible.
Yeah. And that, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But he left, and this dude Jay picked up his spot, and we recorded the full length. And then Jay, a couple years later, just said he wasn't feeling it anymore. Dana said she was moving to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I tried out for Kid Dynamite.
So how long was Bound together total?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
It's funny, like that is actually like a standard lifetime for bands like that. You know
it feels
I mean?
Like a lot more, though. We did so much.
Right.
We were so close and practiced so much. And
yeah.
That's what I miss most about being in a band is that when you're that age, you have that kind of time.
Yeah. So then you tried out for Kid Dynamite.
Yeah.
There was already, was there music recorded that you heard first before you tried out?
Yeah. I helped a friend try out months prior to when I did it.
Yeah.
And he didn't get it.
Oh. Was he bummed out when you got it?
No. I called him and asked him if he would mind if I was like, do you mind if I go for it?
Yeah.
He's like, no, go for it. He's like, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
So why not?
Ah, that's great. So tell us a little about that. I'm sure this is a story you told before, so some people this might be familiar, but if you want to, just a few minutes, like, how did that all happen? And was that a huge transition going from Bound to Kid Dynamite?
No, it was... I had the cassette tape because my buddy gave it to me, and so naturally I copied it.
Mm-hmm.
But I never gave it to anybody. Like That shows real restraint on my part.
I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
So I had the cassette with all these songs on it, and it was almost half the first record.
Yeah. No, I definitely, to give you my age, that was my freshman year in college.
Okay.
And before you recorded, I had that tape with songs on it. Someone said, "Oh yeah, you like Lifetime, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." They're like, "This is the thing they're looking for a singer for this new band. These are the songs."
Yeah.
And then when y'all's demo came out, I was kind of familiar with the song, so it was cool hearing you on it. And I had actually the Bound Fulick, but I'm like, "The Bound guy? Really? Okay, that's fine." But it was like a surprise. And then when I heard it, I'm like, I think
that was probably a very popular opinion.
Yeah, it was a surprise.
Really? That guy from Bound.
Yeah.
The melodic vocals what took everyone by surprise, I think.
I mean, whatever. I don't know. It didn't seem. I knew that I could do it. I knew that I could contribute something to it.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have even bothered.
Right.
But, like, I knew, when I put that tape in and would sing in my apartment that it sounded good. I was like, okay, I think I can do this.
Yeah.
And I wrote everything. I wrote all the lyrics and all the melodies at home. And I called Dan because we had played a show at the church with them. So I don't know if he was just humoring me, but he said he remembered us. But I don't think he did because seriously, if you remember Bound and I called you and said, hey, man, can I sing for your melodic hardcore band? I'd say no.
Yeah.
You were in that shitty fucking screamy band. No. Stay home.
Yeah, see you later.
Yeah.
Thanks for no thanks.
But he might have remembered that. And he's so open-minded, just said, hell, you know. It's been a year and a half. Fuck it. Maybe they did settle, you know.
I don't think so at all.
So that was two tryouts and I had it.
And were you still in school when Kid Dynamite started?
Yeah, Dan was too. Dan was finishing his doctorate.
Oh, the first record.
The first record came out in the fall of 98. And he was... We both finished around the same time and then went on tour.
Yeah.
And then came back to the second record.
Wow.
Wow.
That's awesome. So you've already talked about how you were working or you got a job in kind of what you wanted to do, which was making... Maybe not movies, but making stuff. Yeah. Did Kid Dynamite cause a pause in that?
No, I wasn't doing that. I was touring at that point. I was working at Structure at Liberty Place.
I knew that.
Yeah, I was doing stock.
Yeah. No, you know what? I totally knew that. Actually, this is a funny story. I was telling my friend about this. So I was saying how, you know, we all went through different changes. So, like, in the mid-90s, I was, like, a big pants dude. You know, I was, like, a Fury 5 fan. You know, we've talked about this on the podcast. I would cartwheel dudes out.
He cartwheeled Jeff Kelly. I don't know if you heard that.
Unconscious.
Wow.
Yeah. Crazy. Unintentionally, by the way. I was the least tough guy ever because I didn't want to fight. I was a total pacifist. But I just liked that kind of music. And I had metal-y stuff too, whatever. And then in college, I sort of started to make that transition that a lot of Philadelphia was making. You know, riding bikes, having messenger bags, you know, doing my hair.
Right.
Not just shaving my head, that sort of thing, you know? And at one point, towards the end of college, I had a girlfriend who was just a normal, just total normal. And she was, like, pushing me to, like, go from this, like, slightly more presentable kind of punk look to, like, more whatever. And we were literally at Structure buying clothes. And I was feeling like a fucking sellout loser. And you came out of the stockroom, and I'm like, oh, the Kid Dynamite dude works here? I guess it's cool. And literally I bought, like $100 worth of clothes. And it was, I mean, granted, mostly this was for this girl, who I hate now, by the way. But at the time, I was, like, so obsessed with this girl. And then when that happened, I was like, oh, that guy for that band I really like. And she was like, see, it's not bad. Just buy some clothes.
And I
was like,
see, I had to, typically, if you work there, you had to wear the clothes.
Yeah, totally.
But I skipped that whole thing because I was in the back room.
Yeah.
And their shit didn't fit me anyway. It was, like, too big for me. But I was working at Express in Bridgewater Mall doing stock.
Yeah.
So when I came to Philly, I was like, oh, let me, I already know the company. I'll just move, go to Structure. So that's what I did.
Yeah.
And from there, I went to Urban Outfitters.
Yeah.
Did stock.
Yeah.
And I did stock at the Warner Brothers store.
Ah.
And that's when I left Warner Brothers to go work at this production company.
Wow.
So it was after Kid Dynamite.
Wow.
Had ended. I was kind of in this, like, weird spot.
Totally. Huh. That's sort of a big transition, though. How was it when Kid Dynamo was wrapping up? You didn't immediately start No More Black, right? Was there like a pause between that?
It was like a year.
Yeah. And how did working at that production company work with the new band? Was No More Black?
It was fine because I was freelance.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I could come and go as I pleased.
Wow.
And I did.
Yeah.
Awesome.
That's really awesome.
It's a great freedom.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the key was is that I was like I had just started working there when I got this job, like when No More Black started.
Yeah.
So No More Black had a lot of work to do before it would become busy.
Right.
Before it would have to take away from that. So I had formed my relationships and proven myself where I became an asset to them.
Yeah.
So that when I left and I came back, it was okay. Mm-hmm. The day after tour, I could come back and go to work.
Wow. Yeah.
And I had a chair waiting for me.
Wow. And do you have a specific what is your role on the team?
It was me and this dude Joe who I went to college with.
Yeah.
We were in film school together. He actually got me the job there.
Mm-hmm.
So we were the two guys doing everything.
Wow.
We would go out, we would shoot, direct, light, come back, edit, do all the motion graphics, and then put the tape.
It was a lot of local car commercials.
And
yeah, totally.
All that like funny shit that you see—it's awful.
Yeah.
We did a lot of it. A lot of it.
That's hilarious.
Do you find yourself, because now you're still doing some music, right? Like that's still.
Yeah.
And you're working. Are you working more now than you were?
I work full time. I actually have a full time post production.
Yeah. So. Do you feel like you still have time if you wanted to work on your own kind of like film related stuff? Or
yeah, I think I have to make the time.
Yeah,
you know, it's a lot of staying up late because I get home late from work. Sometimes I have to sleep there, but I work in a spot that's I could work there if I want. I could do the work there if I needed to and had the downtime.
Yeah,
you know, they're very open to that.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Huh. Is there any projects you're working on that are on a personal level?
I just finished this Black Anvil studio video. Black Anvil is my buddy Paul's other project.
No More Black.
That's his band.
Yeah.
And I'm currently in pre-production for their music video.
Oh, that's great.
Which is going to be a short film.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So I think that'll be fun.
I like that band, actually. That's good.
Yeah. New record comes out next week.
Oh, yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah.
So what? How long have we been talking now?
An hour and 7 minutes.
Oh man, I still do want to talk about Alice a little bit. Do you want to do that, or do you want to just move on to upcoming stuff?
I'll go 3 hours.
What do you think about Alice?
That was awful.
Not into it.
Great.
This is the second time I've seen it.
Okay. All right. Do you like that? Let's start with. So who's the guy who made this?
Do you like Spockmeyer?
Here's the thing.
Go for it.
I appreciate him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's inspired a lot of animators who have gone on to do way better things. But I think he is best served short.
Right, the short films.
I thought Alice was redundant. And I think he crowbarred a lot of his sensibilities into that story. Like that doesn't have to be a piece of steak pop out of a can.
That part was pretty well. Yeah, where she's locked in the closet and the steak comes out of the pot and just crawling all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about it, so this goes. We had an episode where we talked about Holy Mountain, and we talked about surrealism in film. And I think, I mean, I assume with Svankmajer that he is thinking that. All this stuff that he's adding to Alice, it's not like he's just making shit up or whatever. You know what I mean? That there's some deeper thematic thing that he's getting at. That somehow he's representing that. And I guess from what he said, he really thinks of Alice in Wonderland as like a nightmare or a dream or whatever. So he's getting at some of that visceral imagery. But it was like a lot of extemporaneous, just random shit. At first I'm like, oh cool, he's adding his own thing, and that's great. But it does get to be a lot. I mean, that's what I like about it.
It's the most dreamlike of the movies that I've seen of his.
Okay, I mean, you know, if you compare that to Little Oda.
Little Oda has this complete narrative. Have you seen this one as well? It's the one where this lady can't have a child, and she's very depressed. So her husband takes her to a cabin in the woods, and while they're at the cabin, he's digging out a tree, and he pulls pulls out the root looks like a baby, which she then adopts. And then she pretends to be pregnant and pretends to have a baby. And little by little, the baby starts coming to life. So the spark animation, you have this tree root that starts moving, and then she feeds it, and then it gets bigger and bigger, and then it starts eating people. So it's like this wacky, like, you know, folk tale, but it's linear, whereas Alice is so wacky that it's so visceral that it feels like a dream to me when I see it. I've only seen it twice, actually, oddly enough. But every time I've seen it, it feels like a dream. It feels like the most, you have no idea what's coming. And to me, that's part of the appeal.
Jay, do you feel like, are you someone for whom... Because this might be part of the issue, too. Are you someone for whom films at some level need to have, like, coherent entertainment sort of value?
No, not at all.
So...
I think the thing that bothers me most about... Well, a couple things. I think, let's get back to the redundancy of it. It's cutting back to this girl's mouth. Said the rabbit.
Yes.
Said the hatcher.
Right.
I get it. She's narrating this. I don't need to see her mouth out of sync every time she says something.
Right.
Which became, it wasn't even an appealing shot. And I think that his aesthetic on Alice, it's just the rabbit's ugly. It doesn't even look cool ugly. It just looks too, the lighting's too flat. I think, you know, you look at Faust, for instance. His lighting is amazing. His lighting is much more cinematic.
It's more denser.
The shadows and stuff. Whereas this, I didn't get a change in tone throughout the whole thing.
Like I said,
he's better served short.
Yeah.
Did you like Faust?
Yeah. I like it more than Alice.
Really?
Yeah, certainly.
Have you seen Faust?
I have not seen Faust. I went into this totally cold. I didn't know him. I recognized, as soon as we started watching it, because you had said he had done some other stuff, like, and he had even done stuff like MTV.
Yeah,
his style, I immediately was like, oh, this guy. But I wasn't familiar with any of his actual short films or longer films. And, you know, I definitely appreciated parts of Alice, but later, the more I thought about it, I'm just like, so we had this conversation about surreal films we were talking about, Holy Mountain. And there's all these parts of Holy Mountain that you're just like, what the fuck is going on right now?
Yeah, you got that. But for me, I suspect, during even the most confusing, mind-blowing aspects of Holy Mountain, that there's something there, that there's an internal...
I don't want to say logic, because maybe that's too limiting, but there's like an internal motivation. There's something, and there are parts of Alice that I'm like, this is just completely unnecessary. There's no deeper thing. Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, it just felt like there were parts where he was just like, oh yeah, that works. That's fine. Just do that. That's fine.
I feel like that's probably the case with a lot of movies. We just give directors the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
Like that something means something when it really doesn't. I think we...
Maybe that's just my faith in Jodorowsky, that I just assume everything means something.
I think as audiences, we definitely tend to look for metaphors when there's no metaphor to be found.
I personally don't need a movie to explain anything to me. Right.
If I'm visually stimulated and moved, that's all I really need. If it's an interesting story, cool.
Right.
So what kind of movies would you say are like that? Like when you say a movie that you don't have that exposition and visual stimuli, I think of maybe Valhalla Rising by Nicholas Winding Refn.
Good example.
And see, that movie, confusing, but it looks awesome. It looks so beautiful from first shot to the end. And even like the weird gory bits, like the head smashings and all this, awesome looking. So beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, like my taste in movies is so, it's probably just as, it's probably equal to yours.
Right.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Except for Tyler Perry movies.
I watch a lot of that.
Yeah.
Are you into Tyler Perry movies?
No, I work in a mental hospital. I watch a lot of Tyler Perry movies. I work in a mental hospital in North Philadelphia. I see a lot of Tyler Perry movies.
They have them on repeat.
Have you read that guy who writes about Tyler Perry movies?
No.
There's a guy who writes for Badass Digest. Evan... I think his name is Evan Husney, maybe, or Evan. So he's friends of friends. I've never met this dude, but he's friends with dudes I know, like in real life. And he writes. He has this like pseudonym he writes as, and he's just written a long book about Tyler Perry movies, and it's almost like. It's sort of like the opposite of like an auteur sort of book, in the sense of like it's like a defense of Tyler Perry movies, but it's kind of like a little bit tongue in cheek. But that's the thing with this dude, and to be fair, I haven't read it. People I know who've read it said it's like unbelievably entertaining. Like even if you hate Tyler Perry movies, the book is amazing. So similarly to Josh, you know, we were talking before. I worked in various functions, like working with folks who are homeless, and one of the places I worked was this overnight cafe program that Bethesda does, and we would show movies. You know, a lot of people go to sleep, but a lot of people stay up all night so they can sleep during the day. And occasionally, pop in a Tyler Perry movie. And you know, I'm not a fan.
I've seen every single everything from Meet the Browns, all the movies, seen them all, including the plays that they filmed. And here's the funny thing: of all the ones I've seen, I've never seen them on a non-bootleg format.
Yeah,
it's been all like burned DVDs.
Now were they? But they weren't handheld, right?
Some of them were.
So this, my experience working with folks who are homeless is that the handheld bootleg is like on its way out. Like when I go to a screening and they're like, you know, we have to take your phones because you might videotape the. At the cafe, these are people who are living on the streets, who oftentimes don't have a lot of money. Some still do have jobs. I mean, I don't want to stereotype homeless people. Oftentimes there'd be people who have jobs, but they just can't afford a place right now, whatever. But there was a standard. If you popped in a bootleg and it was like a shitty handheld, they'd be like, no, yeah, pop this out. You know, literally, I had a guy say once, like, we put in something and it was like just bad. And he was like, Hasn't anyone ever heard of the internet? And I'm like, this is like a 60-year-old man. And he's like, if it's not downloaded, don't put it in. You know?
Have you guys seen in Philly, do you guys have the anti-piracy agents in theaters?
We do.
Occasionally,
yeah. I saw one for the first time this past year.
Really?
Really.
Yeah.
If you go to an advanced screening, they take your cell phone, they wand you to make sure you don't have anything hidden. I mean, to be fair, that wand is bullshit because I usually leave my phone in my pocket and it never sets off the wand. But I'm also not trying to videotape. I mean, like, I just can't even imagine taping something on your phone anyway, but I guess that's a thing people do.
I hate it when I see people taping stuff at concerts on their phones. Like, all right, pal, you're going to listen to this later. You're going to watch this.
It's going to be the dude next to him singing.
I actually have done that on Instagram because I know it annoys the shit out of people. So I'll be at a show and I'm like, oh, this is funny. And like people say all the time, like, why did you videotape that? It just sounds bad. I'm like, oh, really? I didn't know. Well, I'm revealing to everyone right now, I know it sounds bad. I think it's funny that you're scrolling through Instagram and all of a sudden it just comes on.
My inclination that I never act on is just to grab the phone and throw it as hard as I can.
That's funny.
That's always my thought. In movies and
the only thing I've ever taped actually on my phone and I felt okay about was I went to a screening of They Live and afterwards Roddy Piper did an interview and I just taped it because I'm like, oh, I'll get some of his funnier bits and I just put the whole thing up on YouTube because he was so over the top. And I mean, he was talking about They Live, and he was talking about how after that fight, because we were like, I heard that fight scene was really long. He's like, oh man. He's like, I'd go back to the trailer, I'd put my face in ice water, I'd have a little blow, and then we'd have to film it again the next day. I was like, what? Yeah, he was crazy. He talked about how coke he was on. And
Do you do screeners like that, Jay? Do you go to like advanced screeners? I typically hate them. I mean, it's fine to go see the movie and all that stuff, and like you have to write about it, so it's cool. But going to the Q&As, I will never sit through another Q&A for a movie, ever again. Because the whole thing is a shit show, and I can't even listen to it because it's so... It gives me chills how crappy it is.
I've been to a few at Fantastic Fest in Austin that have not been too bad. Where people actually have good questions. But even there, you're in like movie geek mecca, you occasionally have people who are asking questions and you're like, yo, like I went to the Q&A after, I don't know if you guys saw that movie, Apartment 237.
I did not.
Did you see that?
Oh, yeah, I did. The Shining.
Yeah. Well, clearly that movie is a documentary.
Oh, I did see that. I didn't. You didn't go all the way through.
Yeah, okay. So the documentary, though, is not really about The Shining. It's about crazy people.
Yeah.
And clearly the director thinks his subjects are at least interesting, if not actually insane. And so I'm at this Q&A, and most of the Q&A is these movie geeks venting their animosity over the various theories at the director. Like, the movie was about his personal theories about The Shining, and he had to keep going, yeah, no, that guy was crazy, right? He's a crazy guy. And they'd be like, yeah, but that's just ridiculous. Like, why would you say that? That's so ridiculous. I'm just offended that he would even think that about The Shining. And I'm like, this is the worst Q&A I've ever been to. That's not true. I've been to worse than that. But it was just, it was really uncomfortable, and I felt bad for this director. I'm like, don't get mad at this dude. Like, that's why he made the movie. He thought it was interesting that people had these theories about The Shining. That's what it's about. They were very not into it.
Not happy.
No, they were not.
The last Q&A I went to was the Red State. When Kevin Smith took it on tour. Mm-hmm. Was it Radio City? Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. Was it Radio City Music Hall? Maybe seeing a movie there like just enhances awesome. The experience.
Yeah.
But the whole cast was there. It was pretty cool. Wow.
What's the last thing you have seen in a theater that you were like blown away by? Like,
I just saw a movie the other 2 weeks ago called Ida.
Oh.
IDA. Yeah. Ida, Ida. But they pronounce it Ida in the... It's a Polish film.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it about?
It takes place in the 60s. This girl was left on the doorstep of a convent. Mm. So she grew up...
I have heard about this.
She grew up being taken care of by nuns.
Yeah.
And it starts... She's about to take her vows to become a nun. And I guess it's Mother Superior. Is that what they call them?
Yeah, sure.
The Superior Mother Nun. The head nun. sits her down and says, look, I found one of your family members. You have an aunt. I think you should go see her before you do this. I think it'd be healthy for you. So she goes to visit this aunt. The aunt's a lush. She's promiscuous. Aunt tells her she's Jewish and that her parents were killed after the war. Their land was taken. So they kind of go, but they don't know, she doesn't know where they were buried.
Right.
So they go back, and it's like kind of like a road movie, sort of like coming of age, finding out who you are. Meanwhile, the aunt's going through some shit. But it's shot, it's black and white, it's 4:3 aspect ratio, but the cinematography and the compositions are amazing.
Yeah.
Carl Dreyer comes to mind, like Passion of Joan of Arc. Or Vampire, you know, just the framing is really interesting, and it's something that you don't see in modern films. Like, there's virtually no camera movement for most of the film. Things happen within the frame, which I appreciate quite a bit.
That's great.
And then I saw Spider-Man last week.
How was that?
I didn't like it.
I didn't see it.
I was incredibly bored.
Really?
I heard nothing but bad things about, you know, that so far. Like, the write-up that went up on our site was, like, painful.
It's in service of a third one, I think.
Yeah.
Damn. So we usually wrap up talking about things we're excited for.
Wait, what else did you see lately that you've liked?
I have not had the time. So I'm working a lot, and I'm writing for Synapse. I'm trying to keep up with writing. I'm, like, behind. There's a home video release for a movie called Death Occurred Last Night. It's a, you know, it's sort of marketed, I guess, as like a giallo, but it's kind of between like giallo and a police sort of format. But it also has this like weird, the soundtrack sort of adds this like light, like, we're having a fun policey time. And the movie's actually kind of dark, but it's not as bloody as giallo. It doesn't have that like, giallos oftentimes feel like proto slashers, you know, and it's not that, you know. It's fun. It's a good time. It was a good time movie. It was fun. But if you get a chance to see that, I'm supposed to be writing that up. I haven't gotten a chance to. I've been part of this project at Synapse. We're watching all the Zatoichi movies.
We just did seven through nine.
I wrote about nine. Nine is the first one. We're nine movies in. That's the first one. I was like, man, this one's not as good.
Nine movies.
Well, yeah, they're all on Hulu because of Criterion. Oh man. If you like samurai movies, see the Zatoichi movies. They're so good. So, like I said, even the ninth one, which is the first one I did not love, I still was like, it's good. It's a good movie, but it's just the first one where I felt like the formula was starting to get old. You know, like I talked about this a little bit in my write up, but you know. The whole thing where you have this, like, kind of freaky dude. I mean, Zatoichi, in a sense, the way he's treated in the film is not too dissimilar to the way you would treat, like, the Hulk. Like, he has something unexpected about him. He's sort of like, people treat him poorly. But he just shows up, and he just happens to be in all these situations where he helps people. And it's usually handled well. Every movie is handled well. And for some reason, I don't know if it was the lack of nuance, which is what Ed said. I don't know what it was. But something about the ninth one, I'm like, oh, this again. There's another corrupt Yakuza that is working with the government, and Zatoichi has to, like, help the people. And it was not bad, but it just started to feel like, you know, it started. And, you know, maybe that's not, you know, maybe it'll get more. I don't know what to think about that. Because I've seen later Zatoichi's, and they're still fun. So we'll see what happens. But that one was the first one. It was kind of like the... But I haven't been to much in the theater. The last thing I saw in the theater was Under the Skin. Did you see that?
I did not see that. I'm really aching to see that movie.
So I would recommend it with the caveat that it's like a very slow movie with sort of one big reveal, which you kind of know is coming a little bit. I think a lot of people who are into sci-fi have sort of been saying, like, there's not often new sci-fi that's very good. So I think the excitement level has been a little too much, where people are like, it's so good, it's movie of the year. And I'm like, it's a smart, you know, movie, well done, very slow burn. If you like slow burns, if you like a movie where not much is happening and then all of a sudden it sort of speeds up at the end, it's great. It's great for that. But I do want to, like, pull back the rhetoric a little bit, just because the people have been so excited about it that I'm like, no, you're going to spoil this movie for people, because you're going to go in thinking it's, like, some action-packed sci-fi epic, and it's very much like a European style, very slow, almost, it feels very 70s, you know. I will say, very surprisingly, Scarlett Johansson in it, not that I don't like Scarlett Johansson, but she's actually awesome in it. I usually think she's fine. You know, she's not bad, but I don't...
I love her in Ghost World.
Yeah, great in Ghost World. Yeah. But I mean, you know, she's done some movies recently where you're like, okay, you're just being the pretty girl, you know, whatever. And in this movie, she's literally and figuratively naked. You know, literally she's naked a lot in the movie. But she's figuratively naked. She says very little. She has a lot of roles where she's clearly talking to someone who's not an actor, and she's trying to make it interesting. She's just having a conversation. There's no script. At least it feels like there's no script. And she expresses a lot silently. There's not a lot of dialogue for her. So she's very revealed in the movie in that sense, besides the fact that she also doesn't wear clothes for parts of the movie. And you're like,
for real?
Yeah. She's like straight up full frontal in this movie, if that's something that you care about.
I gotta pee.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Yeah. Which I don't like.
What was the last sci-fi movie that you felt compared to this one? The last sci-fi movie that I saw that really compelled me was Moon.
Oh, really?
Moon fucking had me from beginning to end.
You know what? I don't know. I've only seen Moon once, and it didn't grab me as much as it did other people. But I do feel like it might be a fair comparison in the sense of Moon was also kind of a slowish sci-fi.
Moon was like a very deliberate movie.
This was also deliberate. This is also very cruel. It's a deliberate and a kind of cruel movie that then sort of, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone. Mm-hmm. But let's just say you could look at it as in some ways a vaguely sentimental movie in some of how things happen. And I think that turned people off too. Mm-hmm. Some people wanted it to just be like tough the whole time.
Right.
So have you seen anything recently?
I saw Neighbors.
Oh, how was Neighbors?
Neighbors was... I would say that Neighbors was not the worst... Dick joke comedy that I've seen ever.
Right.
But it's not the best.
But it's definitely a dick joke comedy.
It's a dick joke comedy. It's Seth Rogen getting older, and, you know, him and his wife have a baby, and then next door, Zac Efron and his pecs move in. That's a beautiful motherfucker, that guy, by the way.
Chesty McAbs.
Let me just say, that man's a handsome man. You know what I mean? I'm just saying.
So did you laugh though? Was it funny?
The gags that were in the trailer... were just as funny when I saw them in the movie.
Okay.
Like the airbag gag that's in the trailer? Fucking hilarious.
Yo, I'll be honest. I got a soft spot for shitty comedies like that. Like that sort of like bro comedies. Like, don't get me wrong, there's plenty I've seen that I think are terrible. But there's also some that I feel at some level, because I'm an asshole, I'm like, I'm too good for this movie. But then in reality, I'm like crying, laughing, like this is great. So I just have to be honest, like, I'm about 50-50. About half of those sort of dick joke...
I'm like,
I love you guys. That's great. Yeah, keep doing that.
Well, here's the thing. Me and Eva were discussing the fact that we're at Seth Rogen overload now.
Oh, too much Seth Rogen?
I don't know if I can take any more Seth Rogen being Seth Rogen.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like, I think for me, I peaked that this is the end.
Are you a How I Met Your Mother fan?
No. I did not watch that TV show.
I feel like that would also add to your overload.
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done with Seth Rogen. We went because Melanie was like, I want to see something funny. So we did. And she enjoyed it more than I did, to be fair. But I inherently hate frat people.
Sorry.
That's an apology I should probably make after saying that I hate a group of people. But, you know, at least it's not going on the internet.
Oh wait, just the notion of these bros getting drunk and partying and fucking girls and being dudes, just boring.
You know what I mean? And to me, I just hate that, and these guys are all dickheads. I hope they all throw up on themselves.
So, but the movie was funny.
The gags were funny. There's some pretty. Mike Barinholtz was pretty funny in it, I think.
And again, it was fine.
But then I also saw Only Lovers Left Alive.
How was that?
The newest movie by Mr. Jim Jarmusch.
Now it's funny because as far as Jim Jarmusch movies go,
I don't really know much about the movies. I've seen a lot of them.
Right. Like I've seen Down by Law.
I've seen Night on Earth. Coffee and Cigarettes.
Not too much.
I haven't seen Dead Man. I think that's it.
Oh, and Broken Flowers.
Okay. So I kind of understand the whole Jim Jarmusch thing, the deal. Yeah. This movie was so fucking boring.
And it's two hours and 20 goddamn minutes long.
Wow.
It's a vampire movie.
Yeah.
And Tilda Swinton's in it. Thomas Middleditch, is that his name? I forget the guy's name. He's a British guy. And they look like, you know.
Oh, Loki's in it.
Yeah, Loki.
That's fine.
It's just Only Lovers Left Alive could have been just vampires doing shit.
That's what it was.
So it's them being like, oh, I gotta buy blood.
Because we don't like killing people. We're modern vampires.
And then they drink, and then they go to goth clubs. You know, the dude.
I feel like I want to see it.
I know, in theory, every single aspect of it is hilarious to me.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Because ultimately, Jim Jarmusch makes funny movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they're not serious. I don't think they're going to turn your head in any kind of way that you didn't think beforehand. They're kind of weird, quirky movies that are fun. This movie is the same, but it's funny in the fact that it's not funny. Like, it's just kind of them doing stuff.
Are you a Jim Jarmusch fan?
I like. Did you see Only Lovers Left Alive?
No.
I like him a lot. I feel like I still want to see it. Partly because I love Tilda Swinton so much.
Tilda Swinton is awesome. I will say that. And then Tilda Swinton and the dude who was in The Crystal Skull, the Indiana Jones one. He played the crazy guy. I forget his name.
The old British.
He's in it too, and he's pretty funny.
I don't know.
Maybe it's the fact that I saw it at the Ritz. I saw it at the Ritz at the Bourse. Seated in front of a bunch of teenagers that were talking through the whole movie.
First row?
No, I was in the middle
because it was a night show. And there was no one at the front. So I was like, oh, sweet, leg room in the middle.
But no, there's people talking during the movie.
You can't blame the movie for people talking.
I know, but it made the movie that much more irritable to me because the movie's so subtle and so slow. Well, I'll still check it out.
It's getting really difficult sometimes to go to the movies these days.
And not encounter somebody that gets your blood boiling.
There's inevitably someone who you're telling to put their stuff.
I mean, the other thing I went to that was fun was that Suspiria thing. And so, like I said, we should talk to Roxy, but I hope they keep doing stuff like that. And so I went, and I'm at a midnight 35mm showing of Suspiria, and fucking people are pulling out their cell phones. And not just people. It was a whole row of gutter punks. Like West Philly crust dudes. And I'm like, why do you even have a smartphone, let alone you're checking Twitter in the middle of Suspiria? It's like, you know what I mean? Like, why are you here? Like, it just seemed odd that you would make the effort to come out to a midnight screening just so you'd be like, what's going on the internet right now?
You know what the new thing is? And I hope this doesn't catch on. Is like AMC. I guess I went and saw Spider-Man.
Yeah.
They have a portal where you can take a picture of yourself or take pictures in the theater and uplink them to this, and they'll show it on the screen. Like during the 20, you know, when they have the 20.
Yeah, it's like a...
And there's pictures of people in the theater. And it doesn't look like they're taking it during the movie, but you never know.
Yeah. It's like, why would you encourage something? I mean, you know there's that movie out now called App. That you experience the movie with your phone. And they wanted to release it to theaters. Of course, enough theaters have anti-cell phone policies that they wouldn't carry it. But you could at least do VOD at home, watch this movie, and part of the movie happens on your phone. through the app for the movie app that you download.
If I ever owned a theater, it would be a straight up dictatorship, and I would have.
Yeah, have you been to the Alamo Draft House in Austin? I mean, they are tough about that shit. It's like
they should be, and I commend them on that type of action because fuck all this shit, man. I have my opening line for the first time that I'm gonna yell at somebody in the movie theater.
What's that?
I'm gonna say, hey, fella. That's all I have worked out. So Deidre's checking out his phone while we're watching some movie, and I told my line. I was like, "I'm gonna say it." She's like, "Don't say it." I'm like, "Hey, fella." And then that's all I got out before you put the phone away. But the next time that someone isn't receptive to my, you know, gentle leading into, "Hey, you shouldn't be checking your cell phone while watching this movie," it's gonna go further than, "Hey, fella." And I pray for the soul of the guy that happens.
All right,
gonna be angry.
So I actually need to get to work, but is there any, before we wrap up, is there anything coming up that we're excited about, you want to talk about a little bit, whether it's a special event or just a movie you want to mention?
Nothing that I am too stoked on other than, I haven't seen Godzilla. That's my big...
Yeah, I'm going tonight to see it. I know people, the way that these come out, this will come out and people will be like, oh, maybe they talk about Godzilla. So I'll definitely put in our write-up, we don't talk about Godzilla because we haven't seen it yet. And I would love for us to be so much on the podcasting tip that we're talking about every movie right away. But honestly, that's not really this podcast. This podcast is more, you know... Yeah. That being said, I'm excited to see it.
Carpenter double feature.
Yeah. If you're in the Philly area, Exhumed is doing a John Carpenter double feature of Starman
Escape from New York,
both on 35mm. I think that's great. I'm excited about it. If you can come out to that, it's at the iHouse. I think it's like $20. I don't know. Check it out.
Bring a pillow.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's true. Bring a pillow to sit. It's not the most comfortable theater. I'm okay for a double feature there.
Yeah.
The 12-hour X-Fest wore me out a little bit.
But my ass could fit on my back.
As far as also like shows, since this is, we do talk about music a little bit too. Our friend Evan is doing a show next week, Thursday the 22nd. Violent Reaction, The Flex, The Stasi, and War Emblem. The Violent Reaction and The Flex are two UK bands. If you are still like into hardcore like that, you probably saw the video of The Flex in DC at Damage City Fest. That video's made it all over the net. Like, people are freaking out about that. So they're going to be playing here in Philly if you care about that. It's a house venue. They've never had a show before. It's a big open, I say big. It's bigger than other houses. Let's put it that way. So if you're like, I hate house shows, whatever. I'm actually there with you. I don't like house shows. But this space is bigger than your average space. But it's still small. So
our friend Joe Goff.
The Stasi's two dudes who I work with at Little Babies. And other people that people know. I don't know them. So, you know, four bands, $10. It's not going to go too late. Starts at 7. The location is North College Ave. I can't remember.
Four bands. Starts at seven. It's going late.
These are the kind of bands that have like short sets.
I feel like that's true. And then the flyers say 2019 North College Ave. It's actually 2015. I mean, the houses are attached, so it doesn't really matter. The guy who let us book the show, he owns all three of these houses, basically. And so everyone lives in 2019. At the end, or the other side, there's this house 2015. They just tore out the walls of the first floor just so they could have parties there. It's like a party space. And we're like, can we use your party space to have a show? They're like, yeah, whatever you want to do, man. So either they're going to be cool and it'll be the new cool venue, or after this one show, they're going to be like, never again.
Have they ever done a show in one house and then the next band goes on at the other one?
No, I don't think they have room at the other house.
Dude, that could be pretty genius. Cut down on set
breakdown. Anyways, if you like, you know, the hardcore. This is sort of one of the shows where it like sort of straddles the line between the hardcore and the punk. So I guess that's it. Unless there's anything else we want to promote or say anything about. I can't think of anything.
Thank you, Jason, for coming.
Yo, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Sorry I had to pee so much.
Oh, fine. Yo, I got to pee too. But I got to get to work. So thanks for listening to CinePunks. We hope you enjoyed it and you didn't mind that we kept cutting out for sound issues. Okay, bye.
Later.